Woodford Reserve Distillers Select Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey.
Wow, that's a distinct smell.
It's a very woody smell.
It actually does smell like, you know, like rotting wood?
Oh, dear.
I don't want to go yes. too far down the negative road, but like, you know a wood stack that you cut the year prior?
Or maybe your grandfather cut 20 years prior.
Could be even that if it's hardwood, sure. Yeah, you just like let sit there a while. And the summertime rolls around.
A rain happens.
Right after rain, yeah.
Oh, spring, yeah. That's
you
good.
You go by the wood stack. That, like, getting those memories.
Or then one day your dad wakes you up at 6 a.m. and says, son, it's time to transfer that wood stack to the side of the road.
Yeah.
Heavy trash is going to pick it up in the next week.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden your entire Saturday is blown. But anyway.
It's gone.
There's a lot of directions you could go with that. I remember one time I did that and I... Yeah, anyway, so Woodford. Woodford is the Goodford. You should totally go get some, and we're going to taste it now.
Wow.
Mmm.
Oh. That's special.
On the front, I get strong caramel.
Yeah.
The back. Mmm. A long finish.
Very long. I'm still, yeah.
And
my sip was a good few seconds before yours.
As far as the bulk of the burn, I don't even know how people describe these things. Like, have you ever watched those influencers who will, like, it's typically a guy who's in his 40s, you know, really muscular,
yeah.
A black V-neck, you know, uh-huh. He sits there in a leather chair.
His hair is, like, speckled gray.
Yeah, yeah. You know? How do they describe that middle part of
the
drink?
The body.
Yeah, the body. Because, yeah. Like, the finish was just very smooth, almost caramelly. The front was, you know, caramelly as well.
But more of an explosion of flavor there.
Yeah.
But that middle, I agree, the burn was predominant, but I'm not sure what to refer to it as.
Yeah, we are not a whiskey tasting podcast, but we try to be sometimes. That was our attempt. I don't know.
Yeah. So this week is, we're calling it another Sidelights episode. I guess this is our third.
Yes.
And the reason we're doing another Sidelights episode is because we would like to talk about some things that are relevant to us personally. We'd like to, of course, recap what we've done so far, and I know we've had a lot of discussions about DAT and all of that, so maybe we can...
Yeah, and I just want to say up front that in the words of many prominent intellectuals, Jesus smuggling could be interpreted to have occurred. That is not what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
Jacob is a seminary student, and we both are religious people, but we merely... are thinking things through in a way that seems logical to us. So that's one topic we wanted to talk about today. But in addition, we wanted to talk about the role of art in the public sphere,
right,
and society, and specifically about writing,
yes,
like we brought up at the beginning of this discussion before we tasted the whiskey.
Yeah, writing is something that's both important to Brandon and myself. Of course, he is maybe even more of an author than I am, given that he's written books, whereas I've only written chapters.
Mm.
So...
Here's the thing about Jacob.
Yeah.
He has concepts lined out for entire series. Me, I have to spend an entire year leading up to the summer hashing out a concept. Like, for example, this book I'm writing right now, I'm on my third rewrite, and I'm probably going to do another one.
Yeah.
And it took me all year of research and interviews and watching and talking to people to figure out the concept.
That's what others do, though, and I think that you have actually done more of the authoring practice than I have. When it comes to Reconstruction, in this first book I've been writing for well over a year, I probably should have done a rewrite or two already.
There are definitely
benefits
of rewrites,
yeah,
and you're not too far in for that to be, you know...
I don't know that I will... I mean, we can talk about our writing.
I think we need to.
Yeah,
we need to, because...
So, here's a Sidelights episode. We write a lot. We write fiction, we write nonfiction, and it's
so
pertinent to philosophy.
Before Jacob tells you about the concept, let me just say the way it affected me. I read his book, and I am captured by a vision of the future, almost like prophecy, for those of you who know what that is. But this isn't like the unreality of prophecy with all this poetic speech. It feels real. There's a suspension of disbelief when you read his work, because he has all of this backlog of data in his mind about what he's writing about. Yeah. He knows his details. So he writes all of this, and he describes people. And I read this once back in 2018, and then I read it again in 2020. And it was just as interesting to me. And the thing is, Jacob wrote most of it in one sitting.
Yeah.
So that showed me that not only does he have the craft or the ability or the natural proclivity to be a writer, he naturally gives enough detail for it on its first draft to feel like a story that is worth reading. So that being said, I read it again and I wrote a review. And now that I'd been doing some writing since 2018, I had a little bit more to share with him. And my things that I shared with him was essentially that there's an inhumanness to the narrative, which is interesting, but would also be interesting if it attempted to do everything it could to quantify the human.
Yeah.
And there's lots of things behind that.
Yeah, and this is good because you're already touching on some of the concepts I really was trying to get at, this inhuman concept. Artificial intelligence is a primary focus in the story, but unlike many, I guess, pop fiction sort of writers, I actually have a wealth of knowledge in artificial intelligence, both formally and kind of more sci-fi. In fact, before I actually started writing this book, I read two books on that topic, which were cutting edge for the day. So, and beyond that, as a computer scientist in my past, and I've kept up with that, I've actually kept up with that actual subfield of study pretty well. So,
maybe you could describe for our hearers the world.
Yeah.
What has happened leading up to it? Where are these people? What are they living through?
Yeah, so there's two things I want to mention about this world, and you kind of touched on them. Number one, I do try to connect it to our reality. I have a clear idea in my mind of the chain of events that take us from 2020 to whatever year that this takes place in. And I have a rough estimate for how many years, you know, ahead in the future that is.
How many might it be?
I mean, it's roughly on the order of hundreds, 400 to 500 is what I have in mind.
Okay.
So it's a good ways in the future. And so it allows for a number of things. It allows for technology to be advanced to kind of asymptotic limits. So technology, progress, science, all of it, the Enlightenment, if you will, concludes in a weird way because it never really closes the chapter on any sort of STEM field or study. But progress is now so difficult that it almost doesn't matter. It's like something that's just constantly going on in the background. Research is what I'm talking about.
Hmm.
And yet, nothing terribly interesting ever comes of it.
That's an interesting place to get because nobody, I mean, people might admit that that could happen today.
Yeah.
Some people even admit that it's already happened.
Well, that's
but
why it's a few hundred years in the future.
Most people agree that, you know, that won't happen, but you make that occurrence believable.
Yes. And I tried to, and I put a little kind of prologue there that discusses, you know, what's going on and why.
Just to recap
there.
The statement that was a really powerful statement, the closure of the Enlightenment. That's a really powerful statement
in itself.
It's something
we've talked about on this podcast, actually, at least in vague terms in the past. When we talked about science and progress and all of it, we tend to, well, we on the podcast have fought against the idea of utopia. Like, you never actually, or we believe that you won't actually ever get to a perfect state. I think that those limits on science and all that will actually be achieved someday. And I can actually talk extensively about what I think in the particular field of computing that will happen as an example.
Please,
if you'd like.
Please. This is going to be, for some of us, way out of our depth, but just stick with it because this is going to help you really live in the world that he's creating.
Yeah, this is a pretty straightforward theory I have. I used to have names for it on hand, but my mind doesn't remember such trivial things. So roughly, I divide computing into two fields. So there's the hardware side and the software side. I believe that hardware will come to the asymptotic limit where progress is perhaps always going on, but you no longer have the exponential growth that we've seen since, you know, Moore's Law was postulated. So when we get there, it will change a lot of things. What's going to happen is you're going to have effectively longer gaps in time between significant hardware improvements. So right now, at the big data farms and you know Google facilities and Amazon facilities where most of the world's computing takes place, you have a replacement of very inexpensive commodity hardware every X number of months, or in for some hardware, years.
Because things are exponentially improving?
Things improve so quickly that it's actually cost-effective to replace the existing hardware. Sometimes as it breaks, and this is all extremely complicated, it's very well computed, the models in which we replace hardware.
No.
And so in my mind, as the years, decades, scores go on, we will actually have longer and longer gaps between when it's worth the money to replace this hardware. And I think no one disagrees with that. I think that that's pretty well stated.
That seems completely logical to me. Something that might help this have more context, you mentioned Moore's Law.
Yep.
What is Moore's Law?
Every 7 years computing time, or
so X number of years.
I'd have to pull it up.
That's fine.
Yeah.
X number of years between improvement to improvement.
Yes.
And okay.
It specifically has to do with actually the size of transistors getting smaller, which is a very specific way that we have made computing more and more efficient over time.
I didn't know that people would come up with laws for computing. That means it's a very new law, not the kind of law I would have learned back in,
yeah,
you know, eighth grade science.
Yeah, and it's actually held place. We've kept up to it very well, even though some people said Moore's Law was dead. I guess around the 2008 time frame, people were already seeing that, oh, we fell behind a little bit. But in general, we're keeping up quite well with Moore's Law. So that's cool. Anyways, I think...
So where does that
Moore's Law
terminate?
Will, yeah. That's where I was getting on the hardware side. Those years may increase to very long periods between hardware. And so what I see here is that effectively we've reached the limits of computing hardware. And when we reach those limits, you have all sort of other interesting problems to solve on the software side. And so as soon as you have stable hardware for hundreds of years, you actually have the same hardware to work on with software for hundreds of years. And any software developer would know that's actually really cool, because a program in the current day and age is never optimal. It's never completely perfect. It's not computationally optimal. You get it as close as you can, and you call it a day, because the improvements to be gained, there's just so many, you can't get to all of them.
Now, here is a hypothetical that just popped to my mind. What if there were a software program that existed based upon the inputs of vast amounts of individuals over hundreds of years, and then eventually it was able to use those inputs in an artificial way, in application to situations? Is that completely off the wall on the software side, or is that actually on the hardware side?
Yeah.
What side would that be?
I think vaguely you are talking about AI. It's not off the wall. It's very plausible. Like, we actually have systems that roughly operate like that in this modern day. I
mean, really?
They're roughly using deep neural networks and the like in order to learn ambiguous numbers and... Well, not numbers, but ambiguous variables, we'll say, and from those, you know, make actions regarding. And so it's this kind of a black box is what we have in artificial intelligence today. We can't really understand what's going on in the neural network because it's just not speaking human language. It's not even speaking language that we can interface with very well. It's more or less working in terms that are, you know, pure math, but... So
there's a language in this.
It's
this
not
black
really
box.
Language.
Is this a let's
anthropomorphic.
Let's think about this
yeah.
for a
the
second.
The black box has a bunch of.
Is it
inputs.
Literal, or is it a place in cyberspace?
Okay, so it's a program.
Okay.
I refer to it as black box because you can't look inside of it effectively.
I see.
So how these artificial intelligences work now is you have a bunch of input. The input goes through what's referred to as, or what is, a neural network. And there's a bunch of technical other words I could put on that. Doesn't really matter for this podcast. Much better resources anyways. Effectively, it discretizes the inputs through the neural network and trains the pathways in that network according to criterions.
which are set by the black box itself, or criterion set from outside?
Some of both. So the network works on the rules that are, you know, that it's created by. So there's a bunch of parameters that you make the network with, and then you basically run tests, a bunch of input, until you see the output that you want, if you ever get there. And so that's kind of a funny thing about a lot of neural network training, is you actually don't know if it's going to work. You might spend hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of compute hours on training a program, not really know for sure if it's going to magically start working one day. That's kind of the funny thing.
And what does it mean for a program to start working?
To merely just the output that you're looking
to
for.
Do what you want it to do?
Yeah,
or does it mean
do intelligent things? Yeah.
Are there ranks of AI? Because, I mean, it seems to me, this, you know, thinking platonically, that on the bottom here there would be an AI that just does exactly what I want it to do.
Okay.
Then it seems that there's an AI, possibly, that could do not only what I want it to do, but what I suggest it to do. Give it options.
Yep.
Then maybe above that, there's an AI that not only does what I suggest and what I want, but can maybe come up with its own potential paths, but those paths have to be approved by me.
Yep.
And then maybe somewhere up there, there's an AI that doesn't just consider, even the idea of considering, contemplation, an AI that can analyze and not only be analyzed.
Yep.
I don't know.
So right now we're at that bottom level only. These AI are only fit to solve very specialized problems for very specific things. They can play chess. They can play other games. They can work on image recognition. Those are the most common examples. So does this picture have a bird in it? AI is great at determining that. Is there a line in this image in the road? Easy. You can detect road lines. You can detect edges of roads.
Interesting.
That's how AI driving works. When you start getting above that, frankly, we don't know how to do that at all right now. And so this is where we do get to go into fantasy. We do get to go into sci-fi in order to explore these things. And I'll get to where my story involves AI shortly. But anyways, back to my theory about the optimizations. Effectively, once hardware is optimized, you have a good portion of the workforce that's no longer needed.
No.
However, you have very, very efficient use of hardware, because you no longer have to pay all of those people to keep manufacturing hardware. So
sure.
Hardware becomes incredibly cheap, like incredible. You just mass manufacture the same parts, because the big data farms use commodity parts, like I said. We use commodity parts in our PCs and laptops and phones and all of them. You can do mass manufacturing, get very efficient at doing that. Intrinsically, the cost of materials for almost all of computer parts is cheap. The most expensive thing is actually effectively wires.
Okay.
Which run off of, you know, they're gold in some cases within motherboards and whatnot.
So hypothetically, you get to the point where all of this stuff doesn't need to be replaced every year or every 7 years.
Yeah.
You now have open
only
jobs.
Only replace on failure or predicted failure times, and you no longer have to do R&D on new hardware.
So you have all these jobs that are opening up, or not opening up, but being taken over by automated systems.
Yeah, you can automate what needs to be done in terms of replacing hardware and all of that.
But you still have all these people. What do you do with these people?
Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting thing. What I say is the gains that are done, and this is going right to my story now, the gains that are made from efficiencies in hardware can be distributed elsewhere in the economy.
I see.
And I'm not going full, you know, universal basic income at this stage. I don't think that we go there right now in terms of where we are in the economy. My story still is a couple hundred years later. When we start, and there is a lot of universal basic income, then it does tend to work because, well, everything's run by machines that just don't cost much.
And run efficiently.
Run. Yeah.
So it's not like you're not generating wealth.
Yeah, the wealth generation is trivial then. Now, there's still scales of wealth, and we'll get there. So anyways, that's the end of hardware. Software comes later. The end of software happens when there's very little need to make new software systems. And so what this would look like is, take a Facebook, for example, a Facebook website. There are literally no improvements left to be made to the Facebook website. Like, if you can imagine that. Because right now, you've got hundreds of software developers working on it.
Yeah.
Okay? Every day, hundreds of people look at the Facebook website and make improvements to qualities of it, you know, the infrastructure of it, whatever it may be.
So they obsolete themselves quicker than hardware does?
No, it's later. So once hardware is perfect and finished, then all the software developers will be using the same sets of hardware, and then they can actually make
work on the same problems
for that one instance of hardware.
Okay.
And so this is actually, I think this is a field of computer science that's not very well understood or implemented currently, because what we do in software right now is we actually make abstractions. It'll run on any hardware. And so what we'll do is have effectively compilers that take it from the abstract languages that we actually write code in all the way down to that machine language for that specific hardware. Well, those compilers will actually be where a lot of the work is going on and make it perfectly optimal and efficient from our abstracted languages down to the machine language. And so not only will those hardware be extremely efficient, being that they're very inexpensive and easy to replace and fast and all of it, but the software running on it will also run with less power, more efficiently, less compute instructions. It will literally be optimized.
And that's where the true AI exists.
This is not where the true AI exists. This is the end of computational improvement. And this is one of the fields I'm talking about in light of where I start the book by explaining STEM fields have generally been improved upon. Yeah, there's still research going on always in the background, but we've reached asymptotic limits.
Indeed.
So that improvements are rare and lesser than they otherwise would be.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the world you enter in. Because of that, you actually have a implied stratification of society. And what I mean here is that there are individuals who will continue to build their personal wealth in this sort of economy, and there are individuals who will choose to not, who will choose to live comfortable, seemingly peaceful lives among themselves based off of the universal basic income that they receive, or do very menial jobs and still make plenty of money because there's plenty to go around.
Yeah, and you know, goods are in well enough of a supply.
Yes.
That it's not like you're going to have any shortages.
Yeah.
Or,
and so one of the things you commented on when you did your review is it's almost a utopia that we start the book in.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And
but even in utopia, there's still the stratification. Because if I can riff for a second,
absolutely.
You have, in his world, almost a Dante-like kind of stratification. You have a paradise, which is the overworld, and it's very cool because the cities that we see, the New Yorks, the Dallases, the San Franciscos, the Los Angeleses, have all been built above into these super cities, where this iron work goes further up and then spreads out and creates almost a second plane of existence.
Yeah, a big platform or a disc hovering over, you know, supported, of course, structurally, over the main cities that we know exist in to this day.
So you have, surrounded by the clouds themselves, vaulted into the heavens, you have this cloud city. You know, think of Cloud City from Episode 5 of Star Wars.
Yeah, I won't pretend this is a terribly original idea.
Oh, no. Not,
but it is a wonderful setting.
I wasn't, by no means, it's a very original idea.
So one of the things that's going on in this underworld that we refer to, the place below the discs.
Yeah.
You have a number of interesting mechanics going on. You actually have an artificial sun and artificial sky that is built into the bottom of that disc up above. And so that's one of the little atmospheric touches that I give. I know I need to do a lot more world building in those areas, and of course the characters come along with that. But you can kind of imagine everybody living under the disc and pretending that that disc does not exist. Now think about yourself in the current day. How often do you look up into the sky and marvel at the sky's beauty?
No, I'm one of those guys that does that every day.
I think most people don't. I certainly don't.
It's very sad.
Now, if you were living in the underworld, you would look up and you would see blue and you would see a sun and it might be, you know, a couple nice puffy clouds that appear to be floating up there, and you probably wouldn't think twice about it. You would know, sure, that's not the real sky, but it makes light. It's fine, you know, and you go about your day. Now, inwardly, I think there is a building of tension in these underworlders, and of course, that's kind of where a lot of the story comes from.
What's beautiful to me is the idea of existing in that day after day, that tension that you just mentioned existing, and then one day, because we're 400 years in the future and not 2,000 years in the future, there's a blackout, and the sky goes dark, and all of a sudden, you feel like you're contained within this vast metal creature with legs sticking up and connecting to this metal undergirding over you.
Vague light coming on the horizon.
Yeah, you know. It's almost like Independence Day all of a sudden with those massive massive spaceships in Independence Day.
Not to spoil too much for you, but there is certainly that, well, there's something along those lines towards the end of the book that's not written yet, so.
Oh, man.
We'll get there.
Oh, man. For those of you who are preterist and don't think the stars literally fall from heaven, you will be satisfied. But in some sense, they do. Yeah. No one gets that, hopefully. But anyway. But okay, so this is very good. So you have a world here where machines are beginning to become more than everyday function of life.
Oh, yeah, I was going to comment on the AI aspect. Right? Yeah. They are more than everyday. They are just built into everything. Because as soon as hardware is stable, as soon as software is stable, as soon as society is generally stable, which is done through UBI and other political and corporate means, you can have these artificial intelligence, the specialized programs that run things a lot better than humans do. When you have robotics that can generally do mechanical things like humans do, that actually replaces a lot of jobs in and of itself as well. And a few hundred years in the future, I think we're there,
absolutely,
technologically speaking. Pneumatics, hydraulics, all of it for robotics. Given the power generation problem, which I think is relatively easily solved.
Yeah. This is definitely in the future. Like little students have a robotics class in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and they're building robots.
Absolutely.
Right then. Now, you know, there's probably some hilariously simple designs, but who would have thought 20 years ago that kids would be doing this not only in, you know, your 5A, 6A privileged districts, but in the districts that are supposedly underserved, this is happening now, widely. So very interesting. So introduce us to these characters, maybe.
Yeah.
Who are they? Maybe don't give backgrounds that are not written, maybe only what's hinted at, because my favorite character, it's tough to choose between Vince and Benjamin.
Okay.
And I know that's surprising because, you know, you might think, oh, Carol is the one who is...
Vince is more developed. Carol is probably the most developed in the current version of the book. Paul needs a lot more, although I think he's technically the main character in many ways.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, he is the de facto leader of the group. And
really?
I mean, see, you didn't even notice in the first 8 chapters that I've written, so obviously there's some problems there.
Okay, well, from my perspective, the protagonist seems to be Vince. Now,
this
it's interesting. The antagonist hasn't really been revealed, although we kind of feel the antagonist might be
something
Carol.
Like.
Maybe the antagonist is...
Yeah.
It's almost like in Lord of the Rings, you have the Dark Lord, who for hundreds of years after the... or thousands of years, I guess, after the First Age, he's cast out of Mirkwood, and then he goes to Mordor. And for many years, he's existing, unseen, influencing all the goings-on, but nobody knows that he's the reason why these things are happening.
Yeah. Do you remember early on when Vince... I don't want to spoil too much. Vince basically goes back to his company.
Yeah.
There were touches of artificial intelligence all throughout there. How did you feel about that?
Always felt like he was being watched.
Mm-hmm.
What I've definitely felt was that something made a strategic move. And what showed me that was Alice or Nora's smile.
Yeah.
Something specifically chose to let him go.
Yeah.
But what's so funny is when you play these chess engines, like you and I have, they will make a move that looks like it's sacrificing a bishop, and 12 yeah. moves later, you're losing.
Right.
So that's what it felt like to me, a bishop sacrifice.
Ah, that's good. That's good.
I don't know. So I definitely felt like he there was something more.
There were hints of something more kind of from the artificial intelligence side right there. And that's really all the hints that I'll give in that answer. You really, storyline-wise, you really won't get to understand the true antagonist for a very long time.
Hmm.
And that's built in. Not to say that the apparent antagonists aren't. Like, it's a very real story. It's literal.
Hmm.
But at the same time, there are layers of meaning that are going on in the story.
And that's what makes it real, because we have the overworld against the underworld.
Yeah.
Maybe eventually the wild men, who you have yet to talk about, but, you know, are kind of interesting as well. Maybe eventually there's some civil unrest going on there. All these people are being pitted against one another.
Yeah.
And the entire time, some wise voices are saying, stop, stop, stop. This is not smart.
This is not going to end well.
We can't be pitted against each other like
yeah.
this.
And that's why you think Carol maybe is antagonistic as well, because he's not one of those wise voices, right?
But ultimately, like you said, who's to say that he's the real antagonist? He's
yeah.
just another person who's been swayed by some unseen force. That
yeah.
was one of my theories. What if all of those accounts on the application
that, yeah.
that you need to talk about are all bots?
Yeah.
What if they are all bots specifically planted to stir
good.
This unrest?
This
because
this
really happens
good.
In our modern day. We have bots giving quote-unquote fake news on social media.
Yeah.
We don't know where it's coming from all the time. Some people say Russia. Some people say China. Some people even say the United States does this.
And the app is a really interesting thing
yeah.
because it's actually a distributed computing application, which means it's not run off of centralized servers at all. It's run through rather complex algorithms known as fog computing or distributed computing.
Hmm.
I give a couple details towards that. It's actually another one of my fields that I'm a little better on in computer science. So those algorithms are not in popular use today, but they are pretty well defined academically. And anyways, so this application is actually distributed organically through distributed computing means.
Hmm.
So anyone can get on it. Anyone actually hosts a small piece of it. And
now that's...
So when you say bots could, you know, take it over, that's a real difficulty. Now, is Benjamin smart enough to detect that since he's kind of the sysadmin? I don't know.
Now, see, that's the thing that's interesting here. You have Benjamin, you have Paul, you have Carol, you have Vince. You don't need to necessarily go into the plot detail of how they
yeah,
all meet.
Those are the four main characters.
But they're the Reconstructionists.
Yes.
And their idea, what is their idea about saving society?
Yeah.
Culture, human culture.
It's built into the name. I do a lot of subtle things in this book, or
yeah.
at least I try to. While Carol does kind of monologue about it midway through the book, and of course those early meetings talk about it a little bit to give
yeah.
you know, whet your appetite for Reconstruction, a lot of the detail of Reconstruction is built into that very name, Reconstruction. And of course it's a historical term too, post-Civil War Reconstruction.
Yeah.
And so I wanted that link to that sort of feeling. And so I'm almost hinting at, must there be a civil war in order for Reconstruction to occur? I'm really hinting at that by using that name.
Interesting.
And so, of course, that theme goes on throughout the whole book, and it's a question. It's an open question at the current stage where the book's written.
Hmm.
And, of course...
And the application's role in this is that the application opens minds, or the application facilitates discourse.
Is the means by which Reconstruction occurs. And so the thought from Benjamin especially, or not from Benjamin, from Paul especially, is that we need everyone to get on the same page what we want in a society. That's a prerequisite to actually implementing it.
Hmm.
And so the application is meant, and it's literally set up with voting systems, with documents that describe, you know, that documents that people have to agree on, basically, a community trust system, and of course the traditional forums to discuss odds and end topics. But it all revolves around these central documents and building up these central documents almost constitution style in order to define what they want their society to look like.
Now here's the big question, because we, for those of you who don't know, part of the reason this might be so exciting to me is because we have, for all intents and purposes, built an application. It's positiveperspectives.net. Go there, read, be enlightened. But I don't see yet net neutrality being dealt with. Now, I think you're going to, because my theory is that the corporations own web space so deeply, and not just the corporations, that any interaction is a vast horde of unreal people. And you see people on social media like this today. Is this a real person? I'm scrolling through thousands and thousands of people and none of them seem real. Maybe it's because humans are intrinsically similar to one another.
I think a lot of that is groupthink going on, but yeah.
Yeah.
You definitely get the feel.
There's definitely some sense where...
When it comes to the neutrality question, I mean, I guess you can maybe formalize. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is, how is it the application is formulated as a society-changing thing when presumably by this point, the net is no longer neutral? I think we even had a congressional movement on this, and it's no longer neutral as of 2018?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the current day's feature of that. This application gets around it by basically being rogue. It's not on the net. It's distributed computing with direct net. Well, so the networking algorithms are considered to be open source. And I don't say that explicitly in the book, but that's...
That makes sense.
That's the underlying thing.
That makes sense. Is that what...
And the servers that host it and all of it, like, there aren't any. It's all just on your phone, on your desktop.
Is that Positive Perspectives?
No, not at all. No, Positive Perspectives is hosted on a third-party cloud computing environment.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm the admin for it. I basically have access to a little virtual machine where all of the code runs to make the website and a bunch of other applications that I run on there
I see. Work.
Feel free to try and hack it, by the way. And let me know if you do. You can mail or admin
Jacob
or
Jacob loves poning noobs, so please.
PositivePerspectives.net. You know, just email me there and let me know if you hack it. Or don't. I mean, that's cool too, but I don't always check the server, so... Anyways, yeah.
Very interesting. So, the application is meant to almost be a democratic system that connects people. Whereas... The democratic systems have become corrupt in real space. Why have the democratic systems become corrupt in real space? What happened to them? Who hijacked them?
Yeah, a little bit of that is explored midway through the book. It's not so much touched on from the politics side. I mention it in the prologue. The governmental systems are, in fact, heavily influenced by the capitalistic system. There's less need for government in the day and age where there's more stability. And I try and paint that picture where there is a lot of stability because there's a lot of wealth.
There's enough economic benefits worldwide. There's less of a need to go to war.
So human desires are easily fulfillable. And because of that, the population is kind of placated.
Placated.
Placated, thank you.
Yes.
I read. I don't speak.
This is good.
Yeah, so you get the idea, though. And maybe that's not quite a realistic image, but that's certainly...
That's actually very realistic.
That's the feeling I want to get.
People write op-eds about this today. People write articles about this today that, hey, so-and-so is giving in to big business or big corporations or allowing lobbyists to direct his...
And that's kind of where Carol's backstory comes from as well, which I won't speak to too much, but I elaborate on in that book, around chapter 8, I think, where Carol basically... is directly involved with this conflict between corporations and global governments, or country governments in that case. But basically, the big buildings that lead up to the overworld, those higher floors on the buildings are actually governmental buildings. And then on the overworld, that's where a lot of the big corporations actually reside because they have the most wealth.
It's very parabolistic imagery.
Yes, and that's...
Perfectly parabolistic.
It's built like... The whole society structure is literally, like, linear with respect to heights. Like, it's just...
so good.
It's very obvious what's going on here. Even though the government's, you know, supposedly reside
at the top,
the highest. But
2 feet below... 2 feet below the overworld itself.
Yeah.
You're blocked by clouds. You can't see anything. Our buildings are tall enough to go above the clouds where the planes used to fly.
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. That's really interesting.
So that very image should tell you your answer to the question of government.
Okay.
They have power, but like when it comes down to it, the corporations really run the show.
I'm going to do my very best to not make any political statements right now, especially considering the beautiful optimization of this crisis, which many have done in recent days. I laud you wherever you are if you deem to listen to this ridiculous thing that we're talking about right now. Ridiculous to you, not ridiculous to us. But anyway, that all being said, for a while I've been giving Jacob some serious problems because he has stopped writing for almost a year and a half on these particular things. He's been stuck in the editing continuum.
I have been.
Editing purgatory,
I freely admit,
if you will.
I've been irresponsible with my writing.
What's your philosophy, though?
Yeah,
how has your philosophy changed? And then I can share my philosophy in addition to yours, and we can figure out where we stand on this. Because I said something to Jacob the other day. Together, we make one whole writer. Jacob gives scientific detail. He has knowledge of his backstory.
My world is well-developed and believable.
I drive it with the characters.
Yeah, your characters are wonderful.
I just
your dialogue is wonderful, too.
Build the characters and send them loose if I'm doing what I'm supposed to do.
And I like that methodology as well. My slight shift to that, while you might make characters and then the setting and all of the actions occur from them, I basically make the setting and then discover where the characters lie in that world.
Hmm.
And so I almost have a sort of direct relationship with archetypical constructions because of that. So whenever you have a world, the characters that you want to deal with in that world are kind of the most extreme individuals.
Yeah.
And so that's where the idea of the archetype is coming from. I thought of this world, I thought of the history that you know, occurred in order to make this world what it is. And I was like, well, where are the interesting people here? Well, there's this guy, and I come up with Paul. And then he's like, he's got friends, doesn't he? Oh, yeah, there's this guy. I come up with Benjamin. And it goes from there, you know.
Now, see, that's what's so interesting, because you only told us the interesting people. And I mentioned in my review, they become more interesting when you see what all
everyone
of the uninteresting people are doing, if they can be called that, because there seems to be not much for the human person to occupy themselves with in absence of work.
There's a lot of virtual reality stuff going on that I just almost leave in my current, right? I don't even think I refer to it in my current, and that's definitely a problem. Because it's in the world, it's just everyone hides in their own homes. You don't see them much. They might go small little work thing here and there, but most of the interaction is VR. And there's a lot of degenerate things going on in VR, of course, but at the same time, there's a lot of just mundane, you know, human endeavor sort of things. So because they don't have fulfilling work to do, nor need to, they go on amazing quests in VR. They go on, you know, they become kings in VR. They do all of these things that the virtual worlds provide to them, pretty much, you know, to their heart's content, to their heart's desire.
And that's what's so interesting, because that's happening today on a smaller scale. Like, today, those people are the less and less so because of current events, but the fringe.
Mm-hmm.
But I can speak to that. Like, when I was a youth, I would see people in my neighborhood all the time. I've lived in two to three neighborhoods since then. I don't see people.
Yeah.
Or if I do, there's this vast chasm when they're only 20 feet away across the street. And, you know, it doesn't feel right.
And you can imagine a few hundred years in the future, that just progresses more and more until you literally have your vehicle with an opaque top and you never see anyone else. Like, they get into the vehicle, they leave, you don't see them at all, you know.
Wow.
There's no reason to walk around. There's no reason to go to a cafe outside when you go to one in VR. You know, your whole house is a smart home. So if you want to go to a cafe, you sit at your table, you're wearing your haptics, and you get a coffee served to you on your table, and it looks real, feels real, it is real even. But the actual interaction is all in that virtual space. So,
and it's amazing because...
And get this, you can be interacting with AI as well, maybe even more often than you're interacting with real people, because they actually, you know, are the sort of people you want, or at least that you think you want.
Mm.
And in some instances, players will choose, I say players, individuals will choose not to know the difference.
Wow.
Yeah.
They can choose the setting for their lives.
I'm saying a lot of stuff I don't say in the book because, like I said, I tried to be subtle with a lot of things, and this is just missing. I admit that.
It's like an iceberg, though, and that's okay. It's just...
When you ask the question, where are all the people? I say, well, of course you don't see people, you know? Where do you think they are? Let your mind run with that. And, of course, my mind runs, and it's like, well, we're in a technological environment, you know, all these other things. They have all the money they want. Well, they have nice haptic suits. They have nice VR sets.
Huh.
So that's that.
And what's so interesting is there's almost this artificial morality that has been manufactured. You know, that's what I've always said. The porn industry has taken all of the sexual immorality off of the streets, like we saw in the Summer of Love in the 60s, and put it in private computer rooms and bedrooms.
Yeah.
You know, people are just as much sexually unhinged as they were in the 60s.
At least, yeah.
At least. But it's now driven in different channels, and it can be used as a tool. If I was a government, I would use it as a tool.
Sure.
Because what do you want to do? You don't want gratuitous displays in your city streets. I mean, it causes unrest. It causes problems, and that's not to, you know, insult anybody's life choice. It causes logistical problems. So I'm going to try to say that as gently as I can. So see, folks, I hope you've understood now why this is such an interesting world, because it relates directly to our world, because there is detail, because there is this vast unknown. For any of you who've read Dune did the same thing, because in the late 1800s, people had discovered oil.
Yep.
And that had been around for barely 100 years when, I believe it's George Herbert. Forgive me, I read that about 2-3 years ago. He wrote it, and they run off of spice. And there are planets that have spice, and there's some planets that don't. And now we have this new thing, computation devices, AI. And that's the new thing on the block, and it's been around even less than oil had been around when Dune was written. So there's lots of interesting things to this book. I very much hope you'll write it. You've heard a little bit about his philosophy as well. I can tell you a bit about my philosophy.
Yeah, let's what I will more into say, the philosophy of writing side of things. There
absolutely.
Are a lot of interesting points on that.
The way I think about it is the difference between Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Mm.
Fitzgerald would poetically riff on a scene. Hemingway would say things exactly as they were, but in exhaustive detail, and then his characters feel human. And how he achieves this is tough to really figure out.
It is, because even in the characters, there's actually an immense amount of detail. It's almost like he's just describing mundane, everyday things in their life.
That don't seem to matter, but
yet,
they do.
It builds that character.
And the way I think I've come to understand it in the past 2 months is when he worked at the Kansas City Star. The Kansas City Star team told him, and told anybody who wrote for them, use vigorous English.
Yeah.
Don't overdo it. Don't overblow it, you know, in the style of a Victorian novel.
Yeah, but don't shy away from it either.
Yeah, and at least that's what I try to do. My dream, my hope, is to find a place between Hemingway's puristic simplicity and Fitzgerald's florid depictions.
Mm.
Use the depiction for effect when you need to, and allow for simplicity.
Yeah.
That's the best way I can describe my my philosophy right now. And for
your
me,
yeah.
People are the most important thing. And I've done a lot more thinking over this the past 4 months. So a lot of this I didn't think or discretize about recently. But what I came to realize was that ultimately, the setting for me only matters in as much as it matters to the people living in it.
Yeah. I think that's totally right.
And we might be thinking about it the same way, just using different words. So that's in as much words as what I can say to describe my philosophy.
No, I think that's not only right, I think that's in good alignment with popular opinion when it comes to writing. Basically, the characters make the story, the characters are the end all to the story.
Yeah.
Everything else, including the setting, is subservient to it. So you're certainly right along those lines in that thinking. And I kind of wish I was there more. For me, I deviate. Like, I legitimately think the story in and of itself is the most important thing. And
no.
My characters are subservient, my setting is subservient, all of it's subservient. And so I kind of have this problem where my writing is intrinsically less interesting because it's less relatable.
That's not... I would edit that statement.
Okay.
It's very interesting.
But when you read it...
I'm interested when I read it.
Well...
Yeah, we got to find a way to describe this because this is a very, very important point.
Yeah.
It's not that it's not interesting. What is it we're trying to say here? It's that it's...
I mean, there's the relatability, the feltness of those characters.
You have a lot of, perhaps, ethos. And what was the other one?
Pathos?
Pathos might be... You have a lot of logos and ethos.
Yeah.
It feels true.
Yeah.
And it feels right. And it's detailed. It has the structure of logos.
Right.
It has all of that structure of logos. But then the people... It's like the difference between Hector and Achilles.
Yeah.
Hector is... Some people disagree with me, but from my perspective, he's logos. He's structure. He's family. He's city. He's kingdom. He's rule of law. And then you have Achilles, who is this person who's hinted at being in love with Patroclus.
Yeah.
Pathos. Passion. Anger. Rage, desire, murderous lust.
Mm-hmm.
Not that he ever has any of that, but he falls in love, in the movie at least, with Perseus, this captured wench, if you will, from the Temple of Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
So that almost seems to be the thing there. If Achilles existed by himself on his island with the Myrmidons, he's not as interesting.
Yeah.
If Hector exists in Troy by himself, he's just a prince. But you bring them together, and all of a sudden, we have fireworks.
Yeah.
Because of the contrast between the two. That is the best way I can explain
analysis.
It.
Yeah.
It's just, it's very imagistic. There's no, like, one word to describe it, but that's the best way I could describe
it. I'll cease from the self-deprecations of saying it's less interesting then, but I will say... The areas to improve have become abundantly clear with your review, and you know it's kind of given more words to the things I've been feeling about the writing. I've actually like fallen asleep while trying to edit it, and I was like, well, I mean, what's the point, you know? But so this is part of why I've taken a long break, is because I haven't felt as connected to my own writing as I would like to. Now, that being said, every writer has goals in their writing. The most obvious ones might be something like getting published or making money. For me, I actually have a goal. Above all else with writing, I want to write a magnum opus in my life, a multi-book series that describes something. And I have some very clear ideas for that. I want to get to the place where that is not only published, but well-received. That's my entire goal. Now, the money that comes along with that, authorship, all of that, like, I don't really care. I could write that under a pseudonym and give the money to charity. My goal would still be fulfilled, okay?
Okay.
So, when I think about my current writing, I always am thinking about how can I get to my magnum opus? You know, 20, 30, 40 years in the future. And so you might see some discouragement in whenever I stop writing. What that means is I don't think my current writing is getting me there. That's what that means.
Now, that's interesting.
Now, maybe I just need some encouragement, you know, some...
Well, let's talk about that, because there's a philosophical belief underneath there that stopping writing is better for you at times than continuing writing, almost like a fast.
Or I've just lost sight of the goal, but yeah, it could be.
I can agree to fasting. Like, I will probably one day get to... And I have gone through times like this. Like, right now, I have my life structured in three creative periods. I have my juvenilia, which is from ages 10 to about ages 17. All of those things are in paper notebooks elsewhere, and all of them were brutal imitations of other works.
Yeah.
Even stole character names. There's a guy in there named Aragorn somewhere.
Nice.
Then I stopped for a good few years. And then about 19, and there's also like religious poems in there, you know, poems of devotion. Then 19, I call that my young man's romanticism stage, where there's just all of this self-analysis, all of this self-looking, and a bunch of writing that nobody would ever really want to read.
Yeah.
You know, I tried to do an epic poem near the end of this stage
right.
that's a lot like what you've described. That's what's so funny about it. It was going to be what you described, but I never did it, and it was going to be in heroic meter. So
well,
like five iams
yeah.
and rhyming every two end of those iams.
Yeah.
Kind of like the way Keats writes his Endymion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, but Keats wrote a long poem about a Greek figure. And then I feel like I'm in my third stage right now, and I hope there will be many other stages. And what I call this stage, I don't really know what to call it. But what I can say is that in those times where I stopped writing, I got to the next stage, and everything always got better the next time.
Yeah, I can see that. I have a similar progression, I guess. My earliest writing was all done with groups. It was done in a role-playing, text-based role-playing setting. So it's very fantasy typically, although we went, you know, any setting you can imagine. But it was done where I was only controlling a single character in this broader story.
Hmm.
Someone else would make the setting. Well, occasionally I'd make the setting, but someone else would make the setting, and then a bunch of other people would play their individual characters, and I would play mine. Almost like a Dungeons & Dragons game.
It's cool.
And what that did for me was progress my writing. I was doing no writing before. Terrible grammar, terrible English.
No.
No sense of all of the components to a story. But because I interacted with others' works, I got senses of other stories. I saw really good writers in that community and was like, wow, they're writing so much better than everyone else. Let's try and be like them. And so months go by, you know, a couple of years into this process, I'm suddenly, you know, with those people on voice chats, you know, writing with them. And I look back and think about my original work on in those groups, and it's like night and day.
Yeah.
They criticized me back then, my first post, and it was like, well, this is really bad. You should improve.
My only memory of being on a site like that, it was around the age of 14, was getting banned.
There you go.
For god moding.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you have to learn the rules.
I'm sorry, guys. I was one of those guys. Judge me. I would not do it today, although I probably wouldn't be on one of those sites. But
I mean, god mode in our D&D games. I'll say that.
Okay.
So, you know, that was a very early stage in writing for me. And coming out of that, there were intermediate stages through high school, kind of hung on to those things, where I wrote other short stories, other settings and such. The themes were more mature. The writing was somewhat improved, although looking back on it, still has, you know, I've improved much more since then. And then the current stage that I'm in, or perhaps was in, you know, I'm not sure where to draw the lines. Maybe a couple years ago I was doing that, or maybe there was this kind of post-college stage where I wrote, you know, for our group, more or less, the fiction that I've written and the nonfiction, which is another thing I wanted to talk about.
Oh, for sure. Well, if I may, before we transition to that, two quotes I want to share with you from Nietzsche. One of them goes like this: the best prose is crafted in a war between poetry and prose.
Mm.
That's the first quote. And then the second quote, it goes something like, most artists attempt to create a magnum opus. And what he basically was saying, these are not quotes, these are paraphrases. Essentially, many artists would be more successful if they took the refraction of the diamond's light and worked within that little beam of light instead of working within the diamond itself.
Hmm.
And then that might eventually happen. Now, I'm not saying I agree with this. I read this last night.
Yeah.
And my thought was, wow, that's why sometimes it's more difficult to write a full-length novel than it is to write a short story about the preacher and the learned one.
Yeah.
Which I've gotten back to. I don't know if you've seen the drafts. Something's
not
coming.
Yet, but
something's
yeah.
coming. But anyway, so have you ever considered during these times when you've not felt like you can get towards that magnum opus, maybe go outside of the diamond that Nietzsche has postulated for us, go into the beam of light refracted through it, and just write something small, like almost like a pretty miniature.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a gigantic statue of David with perfect anatomical proportions, but it's a beautiful miniature.
Hmm.
Have you ever thought about just creating many of those and then seeing, hey, then eventually I can go back into the diamond, there's freedom to do that, and then maybe you'll be better.
I think that methodology is actually really smart because it's somewhat reflective of what I've done several times. The whole idea for reconstruction arose from a short story which I eventually decided would be somewhere in the second book of Reconstruction.
Hmm.
And so, you know, now sure I'm stuck on the first book, but it's the short story that really gave me that set up that history I was talking about. That set up, well, how did we get here? What's the world look
like?
That's
cool.
Made me think about all of it. And so from that reflection on how did we get to this short story came all these other very interesting stories that just begged to be written. And so that's why I have such a clear image in my head of what's going on, because in my mind, this world exists. This has all gone on in this world already. I just need to write about it. And where I get hung up is the quality of writing, the interest of the writing, the characters and what they do, you know, those sort of details. So
how is this struggle applied to your nonfiction? Because I know for your fiction, you felt you've had to take a step back. You might not necessarily have to. You could keep writing short stories, as you've just established.
Yeah.
But in nonfiction, what has your trajectory been like? I know, like, how have you structured your stages of creation?
Yeah. I did a post a long time ago about nonfiction. And I was doing it from the philosophical side, which, of course, is appropriate for this podcast, where I postulated that the point of nonfiction is actually to convince people of something.
Makes sense to me.
And I did a good bit of analysis around that, but effectively that's what I came to. And so when I'm thinking about nonfiction, I actually have to think about what do I want to convince people of?
Hmm. Persuasion.
If I can come up with a sentence, a statement that I want, you know, someone else to believe, then the nonfiction blooms from that. And then I'm like, okay, I have to create these sort of arguments, I have to give these sorts of proofs or rhetoric or whatever it might be to use these tools in order to get there. And it is sort of like writing a fictional story. In fact, I don't think that there's any difference in writing skill between nonfiction and fiction.
Interesting.
There might be creative difference, and that's like as far as I'll go on that. I actually think they're way, way, way more similar than they are different.
That's interesting.
So, you know, there's methods when it comes to coming up with things to write that are compelling. One of them that's really good is this sort of idea focus method. You come up with, like I said, maybe a single statement, and you write that down. You draw a circle around it. And then you can say, well, what else is connected to this statement? What other statements or words even actually works best?
This is so very logical. Like, anytime I've gotten down, like, I love that this is your process, because anytime I've sat down to do nonfiction, it's like, what do I feel?
Yeah.
Like the last monologue, I even named it something stupid. The inimitable upness of being.
Right.
And then I basically just try to write my sentences in a sequential order that makes sense and ends at a starting point. Almost like writing a sentence in a straight line.
Yeah, that is mechanical. I think that's one way of doing it. Because one of the things that writers run into is actually those in the ideation problem. So you want to write a paragraph about this idea and a paragraph about this idea, that what they get is their transition sentences all wrong. They get their transitions all wrong. So that's another kind of more technical thing that I get into when I'm doing both nonfiction and fiction writing. But my process, I think, is fairly logical, straightforward. Like I've discussed, I'm very story driven. And so because I have the setting all worked out and I've got those characters there, in my mind, the connections, the transitions, if you will, are where the characters need to go next in order to fill the story.
Yeah. Do you
and
ever
so you
feel...
do get some jarring things, you know, okay, he's here and now he's, you know, 500 miles away here. But anyways.
Do you ever feel affection for your characters?
That's pretty much one of the flaws, I think, with my writing. Like I said, I fall asleep while editing sometimes because it's just so. And this is where I want to improve. This is exactly where I want to improve. These characters need to be real people in my mind, just there's like the setting is.
I've seen two ways to do this. I've seen people do self-portraits and almost like the infinity in a single human person is so deep that you only need know yourself to focus in and rarefy one particular strain of your personhood into a character. But then there's the other way, and this is a way that I'm very much having to do in this this next book. Know someone, or not just know them, but have your mind hover around them for so long that you're doing everything you can to portray them accurately, truthfully. And I feel like there's authors that do it a mixture of those two ways, authors that do only one way. Like every time Hemingway writes a book, it feels like all of his protagonists are him.
Yeah. Maybe so.
And it's funny because they're all based on his experiences.
Yeah.
Fitzgerald, the same thing. They're all based on his experiences. They all feel like permutations of himself.
Yeah.
And to some degree, maybe that isn't good because neither of them came to great ends. Now, that's a massive logical jump, but hear me out for a second.
Yeah.
Lewis and Tolkien. What in the world about Tolkien's world is based upon himself? That's like a new world.
True, yeah.
That's a new world.
From whence do his characters spring? I think they spring from archetypes.
Yeah.
And he knows those archetypes very well and plays variations towards them.
And the interesting thing is, how is he able to do that when he doesn't necessarily have the divided out concept of archetype like we have today?
Well, here's a question for you.
Yeah.
Are archetypes fixed?
Are archetypes fixed categories?
Are they, let's say, metaphysically absolutes? Well, not even metaphysical. Are they fixed ideas? Are they actually singular things throughout all time and space, throughout all cultures? Are they the same? Do you have a fixed set of archetypes?
I think so. Every story I see, like we go back to the master narrative, has a problem, and there's either a way that is a solution to that problem, or there's a person or a group of persons who are saviors in that problem. So the savior archetype, or what is commonly known as the hero's journey, the hero archetype. I don't see any good story without that. You might have stories that are written purely in the world before the hero arrives that are only despair. I can't think of many stories that have sold many books that do that. And I'm saddened by that because the story I'm writing right now is very much in that world. There is no hope. It's just sad. There's nothing happy about the terrible things that are happening in this, and it hurts me to write it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, I think that to some extent, yes, archetypes are fixed. The hero archetype seems fixed. I wouldn't know what other archetypes there would be.
Well, this kind of gets at some of the other topics we've talked about. If we conceive of these archetypes as absolute, as something that actually transcends all time and space, they're entities of themselves that resonate with all humans, then we are talking about a sort of transcendence in character.
Of course.
Quite literally, you know?
Absolutely. It transcends culture. That's why we can even read literature from over 1,000 years ago and appreciate
it. That's a good point, So if that's the case, does that reflect towards the ontological argument, like we've discussed, of a greater entity?
Oh yeah. I mean, there's definitely a code to the Matrix. I will say that.
Okay.
But who the author of the Matrix is, I mean, I don't know.
So we're still right there, huh?
Well, but there is a Matrix and there is a code. I can say that.
Whatever the greatest archetype that we can conceive of, this is exactly the ontological argument now, that must be God. Like, that's where that argument goes.
Ugh, it's just so in the head that it's tough for our scientific world.
We don't
trust
ourselves either. That's
even me,
thing.
Who's, very much in the head and not a scientist, is uncomfortable with how separated from the body and separated from experience, that is.
And we should be. Yeah.
But at the same time, part of me wants to agree with you.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up and kind of just say these are philosophical thoughts. These are where philosophy leads us.
Yeah.
And even when talking about stories and all of that, you have that little veil of separation between stories and considering the transcendent. What makes a good story? That's the question. Many Christians actually will say the best story, which is recorded in the Bible.
They would say the gospel.
Yeah. And so it's like, well, you know, okay, I guess that's a good story, the secular man would say. But is that actually the from which all stories, you know, stem from, typologically speaking?
The that for the sake of which in storytelling. Yeah, that's interesting. Putting your stories on a sort of Platonic cognitive framework of the divided line, like...
Oh, yeah.
How would you do that? Like, maybe for me...
Gosh.
At the bottom of that thing, you have, like, mass-produced fiction, some of which are very good, many of which are very good.
But they're all images of set...
Tropes. How is an archetype not a trope? That's something that's difficult to me.
See, that's tricky.
Yeah.
In a way they are, but in a way I don't think the word applies at all. I think a trope is actually a story tool or something that's actually in the story.
Maybe a trope is more culturally defined.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost like the Saxon Islander in the year 900 talking about the incursions of Normans as a trope. That's culturally defined.
True.
Or here in the United States, in The Last of the Mohicans, you have James Fenimore Cooper talking about Native American tropes. But all of that's culturally defined, so maybe that's it. The archetype transcends culture, perhaps.
And therefore tropes.
Yeah.
I think that is true as well, because we never consider an Aragorn figure or a savior figure or a hero figure a trope. At least, unless they're made in the way that's very obviously...
There are, like, what's so funny is you can do a comedic movie of Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings.
Movies. Yeah.
Or a comedic spoof of horror films.
Uh-huh.
Scary movie. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, however many there are. But what's funny is they take the archetypes of horror and they spoofify them, they tropify them.
Right.
And all of a sudden it's just like, wow, this is not scary anymore.
It's comedy. It's like we're reflective in that moment. We look at ourselves and say, wow, this scared me. That's really absurd that it scared me. Ha ha.
But then secretly we're like, oh man, what is the archetype behind what scared me?
Yeah.
And that's always interested me. Like the archetype I've always... I think this is an archetype. The scorned woman. I have explored that quite a bit in my first novel.
Wow.
And, you know, not in the Shakespearean way that kind of makes light of her, but considers the harm that has been done from people outside of her and from the protagonist that brought her to where she is, and what things are created that you can't even see because of the pain that is beget. And then, you know, there's an archetype in the second novel of the... because this is... the world's oldest profession, prostitution. Prostitution is the world's oldest profession, people will say. I feel like the prostitute as such is an archetype, and I don't mean this in any sort of insult. You know, in every story there are echoes of this, the echoes of this character.
Yeah.
And the way my novel is going to portray this person is that this person is more honest than the rest of the people who seem so perfect.
Yeah.
More true to life. And in a way, more subject to redeeming of any kind. So, there's interesting things there. You see that in the Gospels as well. You know, I won't give anything away. I'm about 65 pages in as of last night, and we just reached the peak of the narrative, and from here on out it's just going to be exposition of what happens.
Yeah,
it's probably going to be in Microsoft Word 120-130 pages, which will be about the same length, I think, possibly a little longer, as The Serpent and the Spear. But How does this relate to man's conception of the archetype of God? Can we say God is an archetype?
See, I don't think we actually know. I think that that's another layer of transcendence past. This is kind of where we were going with the ontological argument in past Sidelights episode. It's like, you can maybe, and there's various like theories towards this. God is the sum of all good archetypes, you know, various arbitrary statements like that. When it comes down to it, we don't know what the best archetype is. We just know the ones that we like.
Hmm.
And so in the biblical story of Christ, you play out the hero's narrative.
Hmm.
You have power, you have, you know, salvation, and yet you have humility and ultimate sacrifice.
That's like Vince.
You have the hero's narrative of sacrifice right there.
Vince is the hero journey, at least in the 60 pages I've read. He has heaven.
Yes, yeah,
he leaves the gates of heaven.
All of that, see, it's not Vince. I have to say.
So funny, because you had a completely different guy.
It's kind of Vince. But like...
Oh man, I'm interested.
Basically, Vince is a victim of circumstance more than anything. Now, he doesn't like... Vince is interesting because he's an outcast of the overworld. Socially speaking, he doesn't like what's going on in the overworld.
Okay, he doesn't...
And so, circumstantially, he finds himself in the underworld and says... Man, I need to get out of the overworld. And then he realizes, well, the underworld's not safe for me, like physically not safe. I need to leave. And he runs out into the wilderness.
Now, see, this is interesting because this is beginning to make me not like Vince as much.
Yeah, no, he's a complete pansy.
Now, see, this is so interesting because in the narrative, he comes across as like this heroic, I will leave the overworld to help you underworlders. Maybe that's just me imputing my own feelings on Vince.
I mean, there's a little aspect of that, but at the same time, the actual words I ascribe to Vince
are
almost
literal
always
Vince.
Like terrified.
Yes.
Like literally.
Yes, this is true.
Cold sweat. Like I say these things of Vince.
He's
know?
Like, oh man, I hope the AI doesn't pick up on this as I'm going up the elevator.
Yeah, yeah. So like he's literally, I mean, I could, yeah, he's not like a hero in the traditional sense in any way.
Okay.
And so, yeah, his arc might seem kind of heroic, but he's an accidental hero, if anything.
Well, we've attempted to archetypically analyze the concept of deity.
Yeah.
Were there any other analyses you wanted to beget upon us on the concept of deity, or would you submit to a query from me?
I would like to say, on that topic, more or less a closing of the chapter on deity.
Yeah.
Given our upcoming podcasts.
And again, no Jesus smuggling going on here. We're just trying to talk about the breadth of human experience.
Of course. And, you know, it's like throughout most of history, religion has been predominant in every culture.
So to not talk about it is to not talk about humanity.
We literally are not talking about reality. And I feel like Jesus smuggling is trying to not talk about it. Like the literal concept of people who try to accuse people of Jesus smuggling, they're basically just history deniers. Like, to be really blunt about it.
That's good.
The people who say, oh, you're Jesus smuggler, like, you're a history denier, probably, if you're using that argument. Like, you need to grow up.
Yeah.
And think about the world in serious terms.
Hmm.
To say that religion is not important in the modern day is just to admit of stupidity. Like, I'm not I want to be as blunt as possible here and really get under some skin, because the world runs on religion.
Yeah.
Everywhere. Always. Period. That's all. That the world runs on.
That's true.
We need to talk about it. We have to
talk
about it.
I agree with that. I mean, if we were to do it...
So I won't make apologies for talking about God or anything else here.
Sure.
I guess I misunderstood
the term Jesus smuggling.
We're not Jesus smuggling. Because the Jesus smuggling, in a way, it's like, let me evangelize to you here, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, like, I understand there are some legitimate cases of Jesus smuggling going on where it's like, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses are getting on some show just in order to, you know, give you their tract and try and proselytize. And so, yeah, you don't want that, but you also cannot have a blanket statement like the implications of Jesus smuggling of saying, we're not going to talk about religion because Jesus smuggled.
Sure, okay.
So, we're using the term in a couple different
closing
ways.
Closing the chapter of deity. What does that look like for our book club and for our podcast?
To say, when we talk about Epicurus and Avicenna in next week's episode, and we go forward from there, I see a lot of figures who are less concerned with deity than those in, that we've talked about so far.
True.
And we'll get back to it with people like Nietzsche and others.
Yes, so, we will.
By closing the chapter, I mean we've discussed the arguments for God, the classical ones, and I don't think we need to do that again in the future, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
We've built up some groundwork for the philosophical concept of God, and I think that that's a worthy chapter. And we can kind of close that. We can turn that page, you know?
The chapter now, and you know what happens, kind of like what we've been talking about now, is people, as wealth begins to develop in their cultures, they focus more on utilizing that wealth appropriately, living appropriately, what does it look like to exist well here? And there's some philosophies that are entirely concerned with that. So that might be what our next discussions look like.
Yeah. So let's go on with our conversation then. We were talking about...
I had a question for you.
Sure.
It's probably my final question, unless there's any transmuted topics that come from this. We've talked about a lot of archetypes in art, and it seems important to individual persons. What role do you think art plays in the public sphere?
You know, art is one of those slippery things. When you try to define it, you realize it's probably broader than whatever your current definition really is.
And it's interesting because you can't define it.
Yeah.
I would assert.
It's super slippery.
It's almost like it's undefinable. And that's one of the things that has always excited me about art. And I was thinking over here, on the way over here, about a system.
Yeah.
That the highest pinnacle of existence for the natural man, and that's a terminology that probably doesn't make any sense to our hearers, but the pinnacle of existence for a natural person is creation. And in a way, some people's creation is in the act of giving birth to children. That's a massive jump, possibly, but...
I mean, it's creation. I can see that, sure.
There's a sort of childbirth that occurs in giving birth to a work, work of art of any kind.
And then you have to raise them up, and that's creation as well. You're creating character, a person.
So that is the interesting thing, is what role does that have? How does that influence people? What power does it have? I mean, we can look at the cinema of Soviet Russia. We can look at the cinema of the United States, and people are really ticked off right now because all of the movie theaters are still closed.
Yeah.
There's not a movie theater to be found. And there's a certain reveling in your smallness that happens when you stand or sit before this massive story on a massive screen unfolding before you. That's just a powerful thing. And I've wondered often, to what extent does that influence people's beliefs?
Yeah.
To what extent does this make people feel different things and empathize with different people groups?
Well, I can say one thing that comes to mind that's very related to everything else we've talked about. I think art creates the tropes and the archetypes that any given society understands. And archetypes, you can actually argue, are very close to the concepts of deity. And so in a way, this links art with religion.
And that is exactly the answer I was getting close to coming to, and I think we are in deep agreement there. And I would be willing at this point to ask our listeners to continue considering these great questions with us. And when you watch your next movie or read your next book or even watch your next Netflix or Hulu show, think for a second. What archetypes are you interacting with? What is going on beneath the surface? What's really going on? Keep asking these good questions with us. This has been Jacob Murdoch and Brandon Moore, signing off.